and welcome to OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
A new podcast bringing to you the voices and ideas
of open educators from around the world.
OEG Voices is
produced by Open Education Global,
a member-based
nonprofit organization
supporting the development and use
of open education globally.
Learn more about us
at oeglobal.org.
There's much to take in at a global level.
We hope to bring you closer
to how open education is working
by hearing the stories of practitioners
told in their own voices.
Each episode introduces you
to a global open educator,
and we invite you to later engage in conversation with them
in our OEG Connect community.
Hello and welcome again to another episode of OEG Voices. And we're continuing our rounds of recognizing Open Education Award winners for excellence from 2020. And I'm your host from Open Education Global, Alan Levine. And I'm really happy to be here with my colleague, Una Daly. So how are things on your side today, Una?
Beautiful sunny day here, Alan.
Excellent. It's always sunny when we do these.
That's the same that way.
Nominations are open right now through mid-July for the 2021 Open Education Awards for Excellence. And we really hope anybody listening is thinking about a person or a project worthy of recognition. Could be along the lines of what we're going to hear about today, or there's many other categories. And so a really worthy category that we want to talk about today is the award for research in open education. And we're speaking to a representative from last year's award winning for the GoGN research handbook, and really excited to have Rob Farrow here. Maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, where you are and the work you do.
So my name's Rob Farrow, and I'm a senior research fellow in the Institute of Educational Technology at the Open University in the UK. The Open University has been a leader in citizens education for more than 50 years now. But that's not my background originally. So I trained to be a philosopher, specializing in modern European philosophy. And it was right at the end of my PhD when I started, really was just looking for a part-time job to see me through my writing up sort of period. And Milton Keynes, which is where the Open University is in the UK, is pretty close to where I grew up. So I ended up getting a part-time research job, and kind of the connection to it was really through communication studies stuff, which is part of my PhD. And I was working on a mobile phone learning research project called Motil. This was my first kind of experience of doing edtech research. And I worked my way through a series of different other projects like that. And I kind of almost did a kind of unofficial apprenticeship or postdoc working on just a whole different bunch of different research projects in different departments. Anyway, in 2012, I started working on open education projects, the first of which was OLNET, or the Open Learning Network. And I came in really at the tail end of that project. And my job was to kind of gather together and summarize and synthesize lots of different outputs from different places. So again, I kind of had a very immersive experience. And, you know, I was interviewing kind of experts and leaders in the field who, you know, I didn't really know who they were at the time, right? I was just like asked to come in and here's a project to work on. So quite privileged, but it gave me a fast track really to get up to speed on a lot of this stuff and to kind of appreciate what was going on with openness and open approaches. So since then, I've pretty much worked on open stuff exclusively. So since 2012. And the big project after OLNET was the OER Research Hub. And we were funded by Hewlett to look at the global impact of open educational resources, which was a much sort of murkier picture back in 2012, which is why there was a need for this kind of research. And again, that led to working in collaboration with lots of different organizations in different countries, with this sort of hub model, you know, being the center of like different connections and, you know, central node in all these networks. And that was an interesting approach. And I liked the sort of open practices around that, you know, the way we were sharing stuff and kind of encouraging people to share data and perspectives in ways that they normally wouldn't. So this that idea all does tie back to some of my PhD research. So there is a sort of continuity that runs through this. But anyway, off the back of OER Research Hub, we've been successful in getting funding ever since for different projects. So some of them are funded by philanthropy, like Hewlett Foundation. Some of them are funded by the UK government. some are funded by the European Union. And again, there's this sense of being the sort of central point in a lot of different networks. And what we try to do is both do good quality research into different sort of forms of openness, right? So OER, OEP, and so on. But we're also interested in openness as a phenomenon itself. Like, what does it mean to be open? If it's different in different contexts, can we still say there's some connection between all these different things that people are doing? And so with one of our main projects at the moment, which is the Global OER Graduate Network, which is an international network of support for doctoral students and postdocs who are working in open education research. And we encourage them not just, again, to do the sort of good quality research, but also look at their own practices and what value openness could bring, you know, in their to their practice and what they're doing. On that kind of side of things, and again, tapping into the sort of philosophy background that I have, I also do some research which is sort of exploring philosophical dimensions of openness, like the ethical aspects or, you know, the epistemological aspects of openness. What does it mean? How can we know it? You know, this kind of thing. And so I see the sort of the niche that myself sort of occupies is a sort of crossover point, really, between philosophy and educational technology research. There's a lot of overlap anyway with this stuff, but there's a lot of people who do edtech research who don't have a philosophy background at all, right? There's a lot of computer scientists and so on. And so they just have a very different approach. And so ever since back in sort of 2009, when I started working at the Open University, you know, I could see this sort of potential to do more sort of philosophically grounded work in educational technology. And so I've sort of been ploughing that furrow ever since, really. I have to say I'm enjoying it as well. So that's my intro, basically.
Oh, and it all comes together. I think everything you described came to mind as I was thinking about the way the report is put together. It's not just a book of methods. It's a lot deeper. So you mentioned you described the GoGN. How long has that been around? And like, how many participants have there been in the network?
GoGN was started in 2013, but not by us at the Open University. So started by Fred Mulder, who was a professor in the Netherlands and an OER chair. He was interested in the fact that you have doctoral scholars in different countries working on different aspects of things. But normally there's no one to supervise them in their own department who has a background in open education or OER and that kind of thing. So originally the idea of the network was to provide that sort of guidance, expert guidance to research scholars, but also to encourage them to form stronger communities as well, so that you've got, you know, the next generation coming through, know each other through the network. And also the supervisors, right? So ways for supervisors to learn more about open education and OER and that kind of thing. We took on management of the network, I think, 2018. I could be corrected on that, but it was about then. That came with the tail end of the old grant, and we got a new grant with a three-year plan. And what we've tried to do to sort of move on GoGN is encourage more sort of reflection on practice and thinking about openness and ways in which the network can be productive itself, rather than just these people know each other. But there are some things that come out of this network that are GoGN products, or for want of a better word. That's where the research methods handbook kind of falls in terms of the trajectory of what we've been doing. I think in terms of membership numbers, I think I want to say that we've got something like 300 to 350 members.
Wow.
About 200 of those are doctoral scholars or people who finished their PhD or AD. I think we've got about 12 people who are kind of alumni, effectively, who graduated while members of GoGN. Going forward, we're getting people at the start of their studies rather than they're already doing it and they hear about us, you know, halfway through and, okay, we try and support them through the end of that. So, yeah, as we're getting bigger, we're getting more well-known. Who knows where it might lead? I mean, although we're sort of the administrators of the network at the Open University, it's fairly decentralized and it's open to even having sort of chapters, you know, and regional organizers and, you know, becoming a really federated network. So that may be where it ends up. But for the time being, mostly what we do is, I mean, the sort of focal point of our annual interactions is a face-to-face workshop for 2 to 3 days, which normally we organize it so that it coincides with one of the big OER conferences, most typically Open Education Global. We would invite people to tell us, you know, why we should bring them. And on the basis of those applications, plus some other stuff like where are they in their study arc, you know, where would they benefit from more help now or next year maybe, or, you know, that kind of thing. So we tried to work out who's a good cohort of people. And then we'd bring them all to the conference, but they'd attend the conference, but for a few days before, we would all present, or rather they would all present their work to each other, get critical feedback, get used to kind of the process and that sort of thing, and have a chance to reflect on what they're doing with other people who are in a similar situation. And then they go and present their revised work at the conference. So that's always been the kind of the core thing that we did. And around that, we would have monthly webinars with guest speakers and that kind of thing, blogging, sharing stuff. We have a WhatsApp group and all these kind of different social media channels where people can connect and we can share stuff. Obviously, with the pandemic in 2012, and you know, the face-to-face workshop is not really going to happen. So we've had to do a lot more stuff online. So we've kind of upped the amount of online interaction that we have within the network, and that's actually worked pretty well because, you know, not everyone can go to conference, right? Even if you fund it, they can't necessarily go and be there. So if anything, it's made us a bit more accessible, right, to more people, rather than having this very sort of focused sort of masterclass, you know, seminar. In some ways, it reflects the changing dynamic of the network, right? It's bigger. There's more people in more places. It's easier for us to reach them online than it is, you know, to get them face to face. So,
and Rob, I'm curious, you know, in terms of the students or the you know, the PhD candidates you've recruited, obviously quite a bit of Europeans, North Americans. Tell us about further afield.
Yeah, so I don't have the numbers in front of me, right, for exactly who's where, but we do have members on every continent, and we try to always make sure we have a pretty good diverse mix of people. We certainly don't, you know, as we're a global network, although the majority of our applications for funding and so on, they tend to be from North America or Europe, right? Because that's where most people are doing this kind of work and they're already, you know, a bit further down the road. And so we're always quite keen to make sure that we have people from, you know, as many different places as we can. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we've got members across Africa. We have members in China, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, yeah, US, Canada, UK, France, Germany, everywhere, really, you know.
Have you been able to encourage, you know, because I know, you know, I work primarily with North American folks in my consortium, but there's a great interest from many of them in working with folks overseas. And so in terms of kind of exchange of information and trying to do research together. And I wonder, do you encourage that? Or I mean, it might be difficult. I mean, you know, travel, lots of difficulties around it, but I think the potential is exciting.
Yeah, definitely. So we do, we're in talks with the moment with John Hilton's OER Research Fellows group about trying to do some collaborative work with them because they're a similar sort of network. They're a bit more focused on a specific thing, textbooks and COOP framework stuff, but there's a lot of potential for overlap. And actually a lot of those fellows are members of GoGN as well, right? Because why not, right? It's free to join GoGN and you might as well. We do already have some good overlaps within our networks and the potential for these collaborations. We would always encourage it. The only sort of tempering note that I would add is PhD students, EdD students, they kind of need to focus on their PhD or EdD. Right? I'm not saying there's a contradiction between doing that and doing these international collaborations, but some people might be sidetracked quite easily, especially if it sounds quite fun, right? To go to, you know, go and visit someone somewhere and all that stuff. So that would be the sort of, you know, the balancing act, really. Leverage the networks as much as possible, but, you know, I would always probably say to our members, just make sure you've got the time and your home supervisor is okay with you doing this kind of stuff.
I mean, that's more of a postdoc opportunity. And I wonder, you know, as people graduate and move on, are you using them as, you know, mentors for the next generation coming up?
Yeah, that's right. We are. So one of the ways we do that is when we have our face-to-face workshops, we invite people who basically finished, you know, their PhD while they're a member of GoGN. And we always have one or two of those come back and share their experiences with people and that kind of thing. We now have a fellowship program. So we've had six fellows, I think, with a wave of four early in the year and two just announced. Details about the fellowships themselves are on the GoGN website. They're all people who finished the program. We have a small amount of funding we can make available for them to do a follow-up project or, you know, increase the impact of what they're doing or, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, we've had six fellows go through the program there. And so they're now kind of ambassadors for the network as much as anything. they're almost a little network within a network, right? The fellows network is there now. So it's definitely, but I think it's important because it allows people to continue to support each other in a more obvious way. Otherwise, you kind of get to the end of the doctoral program. It's like, okay, now you're finished, off you go, right? That's it, go GENs for doctoral students. But that's really, you know, not making the most of the network potential.
Absolutely. And I think in terms of that cross collaboration, those folks who are in their postdoc period may, they're obviously looking to, you know, establish their reputation. And so there's a lot of advantages for them to work with other folks who are coming through other and other regions as well.
And it seems interesting because like it seems like from the beginning, it was like for people who are studying open education, but it's broadened now to be about the process and what it means. And this leads us to the handbook. So what was like the genesis for putting together this handbook?
When we have our face-to-face seminars, the most recent one being 2019, we encourage people to share stuff in the group, but not everyone wants to share everything. And that can be for all kinds of different reasons, cultural reasons, or just being a bit shy or whatever, or being a bit unsure about something. So what we normally do at the end of the 2 days is myself, Professor Martin Weller, who's the lead for GoGN, and one or two other colleagues, all of us are researchers in open education. We would just meet with each of the people for, you know, as long as they wanted to, really, 10 minutes, half an hour, just to discuss any issues that they, you know, might be having with their PhD. Just for a perspective, you know, we can give them a maybe some, you know, tips on what they're doing or expectation management or whatever. But one of the things that came up with quite sort of significant regularity were concerns about research methods. And that's normal, right, for PhDs, and that's normal for researchers, you know, to be a bit unsure about all the research methods that they're expected to understand and use. So yeah, nothing unexpected about that, but these things are much less frequently raised publicly, because what researcher in training wants to say, I'm not sure I understand what I'm doing, right, publicly, right? That's not you know, what you're trained to do. But then this raises a question about what's the role of openness here, right? Can openness really be helpful if you just say, actually, I don't know, and neither do they, right? So we all need to kind of work out together, can we find out a better way of doing this? So there was one aspect of that which was purely just people need help around this. And, you know, we could point them somewhere and we could say, look, this is a good book on research method. But the thing that kind of adds a dimension to this is that they're all interested in openness as part of their approach. So the question is, well, does openness really make a difference to research methods? And why? Why would it? Why wouldn't it? So this became then a bit more like a kind of hybrid thing where it's like, yeah, it's guidance, but it's also a little bit of a research project on its own, right? How can we describe the potential impact of openness to doctoral students? And that's not necessarily an easy thing to summarize in itself, and it's potentially controversial. So the concept behind this was we wanted to make sure that we actually had authentic advice from people who've done their or are doing their PhDs at the moment on which methods they really used and did openness make a difference. So we did a survey of our members where, you know, it was pretty short, I think about 5 questions. It was just about, you know, what methods did you use? Did you kind of explore some and then abandon them? Did you find any particularly useful for openness and these kind of things? Just to really encourage people to reflect on it. And so we got those back in, and alongside that, we were writing a kind of narrative, really, which I suppose it's kind of an interesting one because the material itself, right, around research methods, specifically the sort of philosophical foundations of it, kind of abstract to most people and difficult to get your head around. But this is somewhere where philosophy can actually be quite useful, you know, one of those rare occasions where philosophy is quite useful. And I'd done quite a lot of work in my PhD around the possibility of interdisciplinary social science. So what would it mean for social science to be interdisciplinary, number one, and number two, critical or emancipatory? That was what I was interested in back then. And so I was looking at stuff to do with the history of like positivism and science and these kind of, you know, postmodern reactions to it and this kind of thing. So I was familiar with all of that already from my postgraduate work. So when it came to sort of summarizing, okay, this is why you need an ontology in your research, this is why you need to know what epistemology is, this is what you'd call an ethical aspect of what you're doing, just kind of laying that. I mean, and also I do research for a living, right? So I'm fairly comfortable bandying around that language. But I suppose the philosophical side, not everyone can go to that level of sort of depth with it. But then the challenge is get to the right level of depth and then trying to make it as simple as possible, right? So because we were really keen to make this book very accessible. Most research methods handbooks, fairly weighty tomes, right? They're not messing around normally. It's like you're a doctoral student. We're not going to like sweeten the blow for you, right? Here you go. Here's a textbook. And that's tough for a lot of people. So we were interested in kind of not even replacing those books, right? But something that can sit alongside those books and say, okay, when you're reading about, you know, method, this is the kind of thing that they mean, even if they don't say it. Right. Mm. But it's just trying to give people that little bit of sort of a step up to feel a bit more confident. So that was like in terms of the content of, you know, what we wrote. And we also pulled from a few places, some openly licensed stuff we'd written before. We wrote a book on research ethics and openly accessible book. So some stuff we could take from there. Martin Weller's written some blog posts about kind of how openness influences research and that kind of thing. So we already had some stuff we could pull in as well.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, in particular, I liked the guidebook because of sort of this soup to nuts approach where it started with some of the theoretical underpinnings, but then got very practical and gave case studies. One thing I wanted to bring up, this may be off topic here, but something that I had never heard of before was axiology, and it's the study of values and value judgments. And maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that and maybe how that relates to openness, if it does.
Yeah, I can try. Axiology is really, you know, in the context of this sort of stuff, essentially it's research ethics. So axiology is the kind of umbrella category that holds ethics, which is the study of morality and right and wrong, and aesthetics, which is the study of beauty and, you know, how things appear, forms, that kind of thing. And both of those things at the most fundamental level are about values, right? So you can't reduce things of aesthetic taste to ethics. So there's something separate there, but they're both about values. When you look back at some of the sort of research method guidebooks, more recently, people include this idea of axiology as a fundamental category in inquiry. So it's a relatively new idea with this stuff, right? And if you look at stuff, you know, constructivist kind of stuff, the interpretivist kind of approaches, there's always this idea of, you know, being sort of embedded in the world, right? Bringing your own perspective to things and not the kind of traditional view of sort of value neutral science. It's just finding objective facts or, you know, about stuff. There's a sort of growing awareness, I would say, certainly since sort of in the late half of the 20th century onwards, growing awareness of this idea that there is no value neutral perspective, right? You're always coming from somewhere. So one way of interpreting this is that you could say this is about positionality, right? This is about understanding your own positionality with respect to your research, society, whatever else it might be, and kind of acknowledging and incorporating that into how you do your work. Another sort of take on this could be explicitly about social justice, right? And we know that a lot of people get interested in open education from social justice point of view, and they see increasing access to education and all that stuff that goes with it as a good end to pursue in itself. I would say you could probably separate those two things out, right? Some people can be interested in social justice and not really recognize their own positionality. That's not really how it happens in practice, right? They normally would go together, but it's possible that you think they wouldn't have to. So one of the things that we find with students in GoGN, a lot of them are very, very interested in this social justice angle, especially they may be from the global south. For instance, we've got a lot of members who are coming from outside North America and outside Europe, and they're quite interested in the potential of this to rethink curricula in their home country. You know, how could they do that? What might it look like? And so these are quite explicit questions in their work, and there's a very sort of pragmatic idea behind a lot of this stuff. I would say there's a spectrum in practice where you've got some people who are more sort of like scientific, right? I'm doing a survey and I'm collecting data and I'm going to sort of show you a statistical relationship at the end of this. And at the other end, you've got, it's sort of close to activism, really. People who are just kind of producing research for a very specific purpose, or, you know, lobbying or whatever it might be, looking for institutional change and that kind of thing. Most people find themselves somewhere along there, I would say, somewhere on that spectrum. But if you looked at very traditional approaches to research method, where you would just cover ontology, epistemology, and method, you wouldn't necessarily even think about talking about ethics in this way. You might you might have to fill in an IRB or an ethics clearance form, and, you know, to get the research signed off at an institution. But that would be the end of it, potentially. You wouldn't have to reflect on it. So one of the things, you know, the reason for including the stuff on axiology was to say, look, you can think of this as a fundamental aspect of what you do, rather than something that's just sort of kind of added on the side and like, oh, yeah, here's my research presentation. But, oh, yeah, I also care about people at the end. Right? You can make it part of it right from the start and say, look, this is work that's taking place in a particular political context.
And I haven't heard it quite expressed that way in Open before. I don't think the Open Ed group has focused on that. So I do think it's very innovative and exciting to see that, really.
Well, thanks.
Have you gotten any surprising or interesting feedback in terms of people who have dug into this and are in the network who are maybe rethinking their research methods or thinking about it slightly differently?
We're slightly sort of early for that one. Let me first talk about the impact of it a little bit, and I'll kind of tell you what's happening next with the whole thing. And I also want to say a little bit about the art style as well.
I was getting to that.
That's kind of all together, right?
Yeah.
So when we released it, which was sort of July 2020, we'd already, you know, given people a heads up it was coming out, and we had a Google Doc where people who had contributed could go and do some edits and suggest stuff and that kind of thing. When we released it in July, it just kind of exploded online, right?
Mm.
And they weren't GoGN members that were downloading it.
Right.
They're just not enough GoGN members. What was interesting was, I mean, we've had something like, I think, probably about 10,000 downloads of that manual now. Plus, it's openly licensed, you know, people are sharing it. And we know people are sharing it because they tell us on Twitter or whatever, yeah, I'm sharing this with all these people. The implication seems to be there are a lot of people outside of open ed research who are also needing something like this, something accessible. So then they could share it, and it's not very sort of intimidating, you know, to give to people. Now, part of the reason for that, I think, is the presentation, the language and stuff, the fact that it's partly about real life accounts of what the people have done with their research. But also we had an artistic style, which is quite cartoony, makes everything a bit less serious and a bit easier to kind of understand what's going on. And I think that was also a big part of kind of people sharing it and taking it on board. We can talk a bit more about that in a sec if you want.
Well, we should make a nod to Brian Mathers for
Brian. Being,
yeah, he's brilliant.
Visual thinkery, check it out. So yeah, we work with an artist called Brian Mathers. Yeah, we've been working with him in different capacities for a while, I guess, a few years. But he's very good at kind of giving you illustrations and sort of visual ways to communicate some of the stuff you're getting across. Again, this is quite an innovative approach, right? Most doctoral research manuals are not full of cartoon penguins having adventures, right? But we tried to use this idea of a penguin kind of going across the landscape, if you like, you know, starting off. It's almost like a sort of Pilgrim's Progress, you know, kind of you've got to go through this kind of series of challenges in to get to the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do it. And it's not maybe, you know, once you know the way you're going, it's easier to get there. So, yeah, anyway, there's a paper about the visual style as well, which you can find probably quite easily on the GoGN website. We were also very pleased to get the Award for Excellence from OE Global, which was really sort of the cherry on top for the whole project, because it ended up being massively more popular than we anticipated and pretty well received. You know, there was a few comments here and there online from people who thought it wasn't the way that they would have done it or whatever. But that's okay, right? Because part of what we're planning on doing is having a second edition this year, possibly at the end of the year, might be 2022 realistically. But the idea there will be to go, okay, we've got a kind of checklist of stuff we think we might be able to improve, you know, in the first thing, some feedback that we got here and there, or people said, I wish that section was a bit longer or whatever. So we've got a little wish list of stuff there, but we can also now go back to our members and say, okay, now who's got something they want to share that we can add to the narrative? So I'm expecting us to do that as soon as we can. It wasn't planned, but we think not much extra work would lead to a good improvement of the resource. So the idea is we'll be able to kind of potentially keep increasing it, right? You know, who knows? It could eventually just become a kind of online document that anyone can, you know, do new versions of and stuff like that. It's difficult to say. But it's because it's all open, it's very open to that sort of reversioning and adaptation in future. In the meantime, we have a companion volume that we're working on. The first book is about research methods. The companion book is about conceptual framework. And the idea with this is it's less fundamental, I suppose, right, than the research methods book. Mm-hmm. But the idea will be to say, really, that there's quite a lot of confusion around the language, around some of these sort of frameworks that we use in research, right? When is it a theory? Right? When is it a kind of tentative framework that someone's proposed? And, you know, now I'm going to use that. I don't believe it's true necessarily, but I can use it as a tool. Are you confident doing that? Can you make that distinction? Do you feel like you kind of understand the fundamentals of these different frameworks that people commonly refer to? How have you used them in your own research? You know, what did it mean to you? And again, all these things, how is openness making a difference to this? Does it lend us towards certain approaches rather than others? Do we share theoretical assumptions with each other? These kind of things. And they're related to method, obviously, but they are not the same thing as these kind of fundamental, you know, what is research method questions. So it could be that we, you know, so this is still a work in progress, right? We've collected data from some of our members, and we should be, I think, publishing in August this companion book. But again, hopefully it could be another useful resource. There's a sort of third sort of sister to this, right, which is that we've been getting our members to review research papers. So this is another new thing in this phase of the project. So last year we published a research review for 2020, where what we do is we identify 20 or so interesting recent papers on open education. And then we get volunteers from within our membership to write short reviews, you know, £500, 500 words, something like that. We then compile those. And we also write some reviews ourselves, like the administrator staff. We also write some reviews. And we put it all into a report and publish it openly. And so the original vision for all of this was, by the time you get to the end of 3 years, which is our current grant phase, you can then compile the research methods handbook, conceptual framework guide, and the research reviews into one book. And then that is the GoGN sort of handbook, if you like, for new members or whatever, just started a PhD. Here you go. Mm-hmm. Here's a kind of shortcut. So in a way, that's the value point, right? It's getting to that point where you've got this kind of crowdsourced knowledge about how to do this stuff. At the moment, these kind of handbooks, these are waypoints towards getting to that handbook at the end, which is like the master handbook.
It sounds like though there's room for research about the research, which I hear what you're saying. And also that, like, you have momentum going so that the network itself is providing all these opportunities for these larger products than maybe anticipated.
I was going to say, I love that book of reviews. I think that is going to be really important. You haven't released one yet, have you, Rob?
There's one already out from last year, but not for this year yet.
Okay. I'm sorry. I missed it. So I'll have to check that one out.
It's called Research Review 2020.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to be
People don't have time to read all the papers, and, you know, especially if they're not researchers.
Exactly. That's
maybe we should borrow that idea. <Feel free. laughs> If you will.
Podcast.
but again, this is the kind of thing where potentially we could collaborate outside the network to produce these kind of, you know, so if there's a bunch of people who are interested in something specific, right, like micro-credentials or whatever, how do we use AI in open education? Okay, we could do a targeted little literature review, essentially, is what it is, and then just produce that. That's a book, you know, that's out. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't take more than a couple of months. So we're quite interested in these kind of like agile, rapid turnaround things that use the network, right? So we're using the network to be able to do it quickly, or to be able to do something we couldn't do ourselves in that time period. So it's kind of, you know, a test of, does it work? You know, can you do this? Do people respond?
Like, what are the ways that people can participate, maybe if they're not necessarily, like graduate student researchers?
You can join GoGN just as a friend of the network, whoever you are, right? There's no criteria for joining GoGN. You wouldn't be eligible for some of the face-to-face stuff or, you know, the fellowships, but they wouldn't be relevant to you anyway, in a way, right? But you can join up, attend the webinars, be part of the network and use it to ask questions or whatever. Anyone can do that. Write blog posts for us, you know, connect that way. All those things are very easy, very doable. And we do have, you know, a significant number of members who are like that. who are maybe a bit more casual in their connection to things. But I think it's still a useful source of information, you know, even if you're just interested in what goes around on the circulars and stuff like that.
That makes total sense to be part of that network.
In terms of getting involved, we have webinars the first Wednesday of every month is our kind of regular slot. And anyone's welcome to attend those. We have guest speakers and we also have sort of more workshop style things. And the initial sketching and sort of vision stuff for the research methods handbook was done in a Gojian webinar, right? And that was the initial kind of scoping and feedback on the idea and that kind of thing. So yeah, there are ways to influence what we're doing. It's also quite easy to find us and contact us, right? So we're on Twitter. It's our main kind of external facing thing, apart from our own website, which is go-gn.net. And there's lots of different ways to connect. Also, once you know who some of the members are and you work out who's doing the stuff that's closest to your own interests, then you can just basically you pass through the network to them, right? And you find something useful there. So partly it's the stuff that we put out there. It's partly the stuff that our members are putting out there. But the main thing really is the community, which is very, very, for a bunch of people that maybe haven't met, right? And don't necessarily, you know, see each other that often when they have. It's a pretty tight-knit group, right? And it really comes down, I think, to trying to model what it looks like to be supportive and collegiate and do high quality work in this field, while also kind of making the most of those open dimensions and sort of embracing it as a way to do research and as a way of kind of being, you know, a researcher. That just keeps getting stronger, that sense of like the values of that community. And they're not imposed, they're sort of emergent. Right? It's people who are interested in the same sort of missions, the same sort of ideas. And hopefully they feel connected in a way that they didn't feel before they joined the network. And I mean, another, you know, obviously we are primarily there for the doctoral students. The kind of, you know, feedback that people can get from just asking within the network, can anyone have a look at this, you know, this piece of work that I've got on the go? People who've graduated through the program are rapidly becoming leaders in their fields. And increasingly now, if you go to a conference, half the program is like, yeah, they're Gojian members. That's a good thing, really. I mean, it's proof that people are coming through and it's all sort of working and the network is pretty strong.
I think pretty much that's you've modeled how networks should operate. So I really want to thank you, Rob, for taking the time to bring us insight into GoGN and the Research Methods Handbook. And I want to thank everybody listening to this episode of OEG Voices. This is the podcast that we're producing here at Open Education Global. We're going to have some music that will be in the final production. It's open license. It's called Joyful Meeting by artist named Crowander, found in Free Music Archive, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial. And so you'll find this episode at voices.oeglobal.org. And we really want you to engage to follow up in conversations with Rob in our space at OEG Connect. And again, we really appreciate you bringing this in and want to remind people that, again, that we really encourage you to think about nominating similar projects or other projects for this year's Open Education Global Awards. And we'll be talking to them throughout next year again and just repeating this cycle. So I really appreciate it. Thank you, Rob and Una, for sitting in on this conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great. Wonderful to see you, Rob.
You too.